Thanks for downloading this show from PC One. Before we get rolling, here's a word from one of the folks who helped bring you this podcast. Since 1983, Eddie Trunk has been the voice for fans of rock, hard rock, and heavy metal. A best-selling author, host of TV's That Metal Show, and seven national radio shows, including Trunk Nation, daily on Sirius XM.
Interesting.
Eddie offers the world his news-making interviews, passionate analysis, honest commentary, and who knows what else. So welcome to the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
A Thursday, that's our post day where we bring you a new podcast, and it's great to have you guys on board. And thanks to my good friend Mr. Mark Slaughter for bringing you our open music there. That is the guitar stylings of Mark. As a matter of fact, Mark Slaughter had him on my radio show not too long ago. He has a new record coming out. We'll be sure to have him on this podcast as well when that record is ready. Mark Slaughter, quite a guitar player. It's interesting because people don't think of him as a guitar player, even though that is his background. Basically just being more known just for handling the mic for all those years as a member of Slaughter. Anyway, good to have you guys here with us for another week of the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Appreciate you listening wherever you listen around the world and downloading and streaming. You do that for free, and that's thanks to our great sponsors. Remember, go to podcastone.com. You'll find all the great sponsors of the Eddie Trunk Podcast. And because of them, we can bring you this podcast each week with limited ads and no additional cost to you. And if you heard a sponsor that you want to try out or forgot a sponsor and want to see a full list, you can access them by going to the Killer Deals button at podcastone.com and visiting the Eddie Trunk Podcast page. We only approve sponsors who make sense for my audience, and each of my sponsors are listed there with the banners linked to the promotional deal and the promos listed by the brands. Everything you need, easily accessible in one place. That is my page at podcastone.com and the Killer Deals button. So thanks to all those sponsors. Thanks to you for supporting them. In addition to the Eddie Trunk Podcast sponsors and the Killer Deals menu bar there, we also participate in the Amazon Associates program. That is an affiliate advertising program designed to provide a means for me to earn fees by linking to Amazon.com and affiliated sites. You can link to Amazon at podcastone.com. All right. So, this week, after a big, big podcast that was much, much loved last week with the members of Triumph, my second interview that took place in Toronto, Canada, actually the day before the Triumph interview, and that is with legendary producer Bob Ezrin. As usual, most of my interviews here on the Eddie Trunk Podcast originate on my daily radio show on Sirius XM Volume Channel 106, where you can hear me live 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, or catch the replay every night 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time. And I went to Toronto to interview Bob Ezrin. Now, I love talking to producers, behind-the-scenes people in the world of music, and Ezrin is one of the top in the food chain as far as that line of interview is concerned. And my history with Bob Ezrin is very recent. I had him on my radio show to discuss Kiss Destroyer. And it wasn't a particularly landmark anniversary. I think it was 41st anniversary or whatever of that record. But it was a good excuse to try to reach out to him and get him to come on the radio show, and he did. He was nice enough to do it, and he called in, and it was a very brief conversation. We spoke for like 10, 15 minutes. He was in the middle of working with Alice Cooper. This is just like 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago. And I'd said to Bob, man, I would absolutely love to be able to have you on for a full show. And we went back and forth a little bit, and he actually checked me out through Alice Cooper to make sure that I guess he'd get a fair shake and I wasn't a quack. Alice Cooper, thankfully, gave me a big thumbs up. And then we started talking about logistics because I really wanted to be able to do the interview with Bob in a studio and not on the phone if I could help it. And Bob asked if Sirius XM had a studio in Toronto, and I did not know that we did, but we do. So it was of enough value to the brass at Sirius XM to send me to Toronto to have him live on the air with me for that interview. And we had a great, great conversation, and you're about to hear that conversation. I spent pretty much almost the entire 2 hours with him. So here on the podcast, you'll get nearly a 2 hour interview with Bob Ezrin. I did a little open at the top and then the Ezrin interview, which I believe is where we'll pick things up. And I believe at the end, if my memory recalls, we may have crammed in a few phone calls from the audience listening for Bob as well. But listen, Bob Ezrin's history speaks for itself. Whether it be Alice Cooper, whether it be Pink Floyd, whether it be Kiss, whether it be so many other records you wouldn't even believe and think that he worked on, records like Hanoi Rocks and The Throbs and some other stuff too that, I mean, the list is way too long and I won't recount it here. And, you know, even with 2 hours with Bob, there were still a ton of things I didn't get through. As I was going through this interview and talking about his earliest days and his childhood, I started to realize, like, for my radio audience, I'm like, oh my God, I'm running out of time here. I got like a half an hour left to go and I got to wrap it up. So I quickly had to move a little faster to touch on as many things as I could before I ran out of time for the radio audience, which again, is where this interview originated. So I think you guys are going to enjoy this. Bob Ezrin, legend in the world of music production, coming up for almost 2 hours on this week's Eddie Trunk podcast. I'm sure with our commercials and breaks cut out from the radio show, and if we pick it up with leaving out my intro from Canada that day, I'm sure we're looking at a good hour and a half solid with Bob. Just a quick note, this weekend is the M3 Festival. If you're listening to this on post day live Thursday, I'm driving to Maryland and getting ready to be back to host that Friday and Saturday. Very much looking forward to that. May 7th, we have the Ride for Ronnie coming up in Encino, California. May 5th, I'll be hosting Dokken at the IDL Ballroom in Tulsa. A week of broadcasts, spending a week in Los Angeles the week of May 8th, where I will be there and doing my radio show each and every day. A lot of travel, a lot of good stuff coming up. And hope you guys follow on Twitter, at Eddie Trunk, Instagram, Facebook, at Eddie Trunk. EddieTrunk.com is the website. When you're on my site, as usual, you got the merch store, which is the place where you can get Trunk Nation stuff, Eddie Trunk stuff. You can also email me through the site. You can also read music news updated daily. So much to do on EddieTrunk.com, including all my appearances, just the few I just mentioned, just a few of the ones coming up. As they come in and are locked in, they will appear on my website right there on the homepage. Hope to see you out and about as I get ready to do some traveling and the summer concert season starts to kick off. All right, let's get a break here and then come right back and get into it. You guys are going to love this. I know you're going to love this. Bob Ezrin, brand new interview on the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
The Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Well, in order to feel comfortable that you're getting a fair price, you need pricing context information that empowers you to feel confident when you're buying a car. And with TrueCar, you'll see what other people in your local market paid for the car you want. What's better than that? From there, of course, you can connect with a local TrueCar certified dealer and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Using TrueCar, you can easily find the car you want. TrueCar will show you what other people in your area paid for the car you want, and now you know what a fair price is, so you can feel confident. And once you register, you'll see real pricing on actual inventory. This is competitive pricing offered to you only by a TrueCar certified dealer for an actual vehicle on their lot. And it's pricing you'll see before going to a dealership, so you can feel confident when you show up. With TrueCar, you can connect with a local certified dealer of your choosing so you can enjoy a quick, easy buying experience. TrueCar customers, well, they're more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with TrueCar certified dealers. And TrueCar users, they save an average of over $3,000 off MSRP. So when you're ready to buy, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states.
Hey, this is Richard Marks, the host of Song Talks, right here on Podcast One. Every week, I will explore the impact music has on our lives through interviews with singers, songwriters, and other amazing guests about the classic songs that have impacted them. Check out Song Talks every Wednesday at PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, or subscribe at iTunes.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen, remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah, of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well...
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
All right, without further ado, let's get into it. It is a good lengthy one. The entire podcast this week is with legendary producer Bob Ezrin from Toronto, Canada. Again, this interview originated on my SiriusXM radio show, Trunk Nation, which you can hear daily Monday through Friday from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on Channel 106 Volume. Enjoy, ladies and gentlemen. I know you will. Good to see you, Bob.
Thank you, Eddie.
Well, good to see you, man, and it's great to meet you face-to-face. I know you called into this show like a month ago, and at that time we said, you know, hey, it'd be great to do a whole show with you, and you were nice enough to make some time out of, I know, a very busy schedule to talk about your career and your history, and here on your home turf. I mean, do you live in Toronto, or do you live in Nashville, or do you live both?
The answer is yes. we live both. I'm a resident of Tennessee. I live in Nashville, Tennessee, but we have a house in Toronto, and my wife is a resident of Toronto.
Oh, okay.
So I get up here as much as I possibly can. But as you know, this job takes you all over the world, and we spend a lot of time in other places.
Where do you do the bulk of your work these days? Your studio is in Nashville?
Yeah, my studio is in Nashville. So the bulk of the Bob work, because there's various stages of stuff when I'm working on it. The bulk of the Bob work is Nashville. I have my setup, my team. It's very easy for me to work there, and Nashville is an incredibly rich place in terms of resources for music, for anything to do with music.
Right.
Studios, players, equipment, anything. So, so that's where I'll do the most of that. But recording can happen anywhere.
I want to start at the beginning with you because we are here in Toronto, which is your home area. And you,
Toronto. Hey, Donna. Still wanna? You said to call you up when I was in
Toronto. There you go.
Name that tune, Eddie.
What is it?
Come on. Switching the Glide.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Switching the Glide.
That
was a great song.
It was a good song.
It was a great song. But you started, tell me about growing up here. Your family, you guys originally from here, born and raised, and where was the first introduction for the young Bob Ezrin to the world of music? Like, what was your first exposure?
I've often said that I was incredibly lucky to grow up in this city at the time that I did. We were going through an artistic explosion in Toronto in the 60s, and there were a lot of really great musicians and players that were here, like Oscar Peterson. When I was taking, as an example, my parents sent me to jazz guitar lessons with a great jazz guitar player named Hank Monas, who was internationally renowned. But on the other side of the window that I sat at in his studio, 18 inches away in the next building, was Oscar Peterson Trio rehearsing. So you can imagine I didn't get much jazz guitar done because I was like completely obsessed with watching Ray Brown and the way that he could play. Anyway, we had a lot of radio. We had a lot of TV here, and the CBC was an amazing resource. Within our family, we had lots of musicians. My grandfather on my mom's side was a linotype operator by day and a song and dance man by night. He was an amateur vaudevillian. He only lived until I was five, but in those first years, I will always remember doing song and dance routines with him, soft shoe with him, and learning how to sing Me and My Shadow, and which I did with my daughter many years later on a cruise. Anyway, so we had that. My mother was a pianist. My dad played bass in one of Canada's most famous big bands, the Bobby Jimby Orchestra, to work his way through medical school. And my uncle Sid was the largest private collector of jazz recordings in Canada, and half owner of two coffee houses, one of which was on Yorkville Avenue here, and part of the Yorkville Village. That's a whole other conversation. Anyway, so that's the family side. And then completely by accident, one of my mom's best friends was a dancer with the CBC, and she invited the kids to come down and just see the studio. So my younger brothers, who are redheaded twins, went down and got spotted in the hallway by the producers of a TV show on Saturday night featuring a redheaded Irish tenor named Billy O'Connor. And they said, well, these kids don't sing, do they? And my dad went, 5, 6, 7, 8. You know, my brother's broken. I want a girl just like the girl that married dear. So they went, you're hired. And they ended up being special guests on the Christmas show. And then they said, have you got any more of those at home? And I started working, too, at the CBC. These were not stage parents. Let me get it straight here. They were like, they didn't see this as being anything particularly different from our singing and dancing at family parties. So I would just go to school, and I'd have a note that would say, please excuse Bobby's absence this afternoon. He has a TV show to tape. And I would just get on a streetcar by myself, go down to Jarvis Studio 4 here at CBC, sit in the green room, which I loved because they had a hot chocolate machine, which is the best hot chocolate in the world, by myself, no stage parents, none of that stuff. And then we'd go and do the show. And I played at one point, I played Johnny Wayne's son on the Wayne and Schuster show. You're too young to even know who they are.
Right. But you're singing at this point?
Yes.
Well, you're just singing. You're not playing any instruments.
No, not playing any instruments there.
So the first thing.
But we did start, all of us started piano and other kinds of musical lessons.
Did it come easy to you?
Yeah, sure.
So getting in, learning new instruments and learning piano or learning all, it was an easy thing. It wasn't. It seemed very natural.
It was totally natural. It was an all-singing, all-dancing family.
Were you self-taught, or were you taking lessons at that point?
No, I took lessons. I started off with Mrs. Beener, who would give me a sensen if I was a good boy and had practiced my scales. No, we all took lessons. I went to the Royal Conservatory of Music for 5 minutes here before I got kicked out, as I did from...
Why did you get kicked out?
Pretty much, I got kicked out of pretty much every school I was sent to in Toronto.
Why?
Because I was a rebel and I'd never be any good.
Was that you were told?
Well, I was told I'd never be any good, and yes, I was a rebel.
Wow. Did that drive you?
You know, I didn't see, I mean, school was, it was kind of dull for me. My dad was a brilliant scientist and doctor and a professor of medicine here. And the conversations we'd have around the dinner table, the people that would come to our house and just sit and talk and all that stuff that was happening after school was so heady and brilliant and informed. And then I'd go to school and someone would talk to me like an 8-year-old. Okay, I was an 8-year-old, but I was used to being talked to like a young adult. I resented it. I found myself resenting it. And I was checking out amongst the peer group too. I had a few friends here who were really smart, really interesting, really kind of, you know, we were bohemians.
Did you graduate high school? Did you go all the way through school?
Barely.
Barely.
Yes, I did. I got kicked out of high schools, and then had to finish in here. We had grade 13 here, mm-hmm. which was the equivalent of first year university now. So I got kicked out of grade 13 halfway through, and had to study on my own and write the exams on my own.
Did you? Most people and everybody knows you as a producer, and we're going to talk about your records and some of the bands you worked with. And again, we will take calls towards the end of the show for the audience as well. But I'm curious about the transition going from producer, which I want to get to where that started, but you're getting all this experience as a musician. You're learning all these different instruments and you're doing all this. So was there a thought, and did you, maybe I'm unaware of it, did you have bands? Were you on the performing end of it and released a lot of music?
I was in a little folk group called The Messengers, which was my mother's maiden name, and that was my cousin Nancy, whose mother's maiden name was also Messenger. She and I had a folk duo. We used to play at the Penny Farthing, which my uncle co-owned. And at the same time, there was this girl from out west, beautiful blonde girl from out west named Joni Anderson that would play. That's Joni Mitchell.
Uh-huh.
And people like Jose Feliciano played his first ever North American gig there. But also, Gordy Lightfoot was just down the street. Next door was a band playing called the Mina Bird, and that was Rick James and Neil Young as co-frontmen of a soul band.
Wow.
Believe it or not.
Wow.
And down the street from there was a group called The Sparrow, which was John Kay and a guy who later became Mars Bonfire, and they became Steppenwolf, right? And all of this was happening at the same time. It was amazing to be on that street at that time in Toronto.
So where does the decision, though, because there's an interesting sort of split that happens here, because you're learning these instruments, you're doing some performing and some playing, but then you break off and decide, instead of being the guy on the stage that everybody's going to see playing and become the quote-unquote rock stars, you're going to go another path. You want to be the guy behind the scenes shaping those guys and making these records and producing and crafting these records. Where does that division happen?
Well, I like playing with the stuff. I like playing with the gear, you know.
And even here when you came in, you're asking about how does this work and how you making the connection.
Well,
I need one of those.
I can't help myself.
Tech junkie.
So my uncle, who had this large jazz collection, also had tape machines and he had turntables. And my parents, when I was probably 10 or 11, I got a tape machine for Hanukkah. That was my gift. It was a little cheap Sears tape machine, but I would sit in my window and I would record and talk to myself. I was Bob King with the King thing. I had the King thing all night in Toronto. And then I have this little, like my little record player, and I'd put records on in the background and then I'd
talk. So you're doing a radio show to tape.
I was doing a radio show to tape for myself. But I just loved tape. I loved the smell of tape. And because we were doing TV and stuff, we were in studios a lot. We were doing commercials as well. We were the voices of Shreddies, which was like mini shredded wheat up here in Canada. And so we did a lot of studio stuff. I just loved the studio. I fell in love with it.
Yeah.
And I didn't really think that was any different from being on the stage. To me, it was all just creating, making, singing, playing stuff. And how it happened that I got a producer job was because I was doing musical theater here as well, and I was the script
acting in it. Or
no, I was the script editor of a show that was a yearly review, an annual review here in Toronto, and I hired writers to write sketches. I hired Lorne Michaels and Hart Pomerantz, his partner,
wow,
to write sketches for this stuff, and we had they wanted to do it was a musical review, and they decided, well, we're going to do rock music because we need to be groovy, so we're going to do rock music. At that time, Michael Cole, who is perhaps the greatest concert promoter of all time and was manager of the Rolling Stones, but also the guy who invented global touring, Michael Cole, also from Toronto, and I were co-managing, I'm making air quotes,
right,
co-managing a band called Icarus. Lead singer was a guy named Eddie Schwartz, who wrote a song called "Hit Me with Your Best Shot."
This is Pat Benatar.
Yeah, so and we were co-managers, and I thought management meant working on their songs with them, and working on arrangements, and Michael thought it meant booking him in clubs, you know, and so that was sort of the definition of our you know, separate career paths. But anyway, I talked them into hiring our band for the show, and then the guy who was the music director, he was a little uncomfortable with the genre, the form, so I said, no worries, I'll take care of it. And I ended up doing arrangements for the material for the show and finding songs. I got song from Bruce Coburn and songs for all these great young writers and stuff. And he liked what I did, and he said, I want you to meet my partner, Jack Richardson, who is the producer of the Guess Who. Mm-hmm. He could use a guy like you. Mm. So I went into Jack's office and said, I'd like to be a manager. And he said, no, you don't want to be a manager. You want to be a producer.
Did you learn the ropes under him to
Absolutely.
Some degree? He was very much your mentor?
Yeah, not to some degree, to every degree. I would have no career if it weren't for Jack Richardson. He said, you want to be a producer, and this is how it works. He sent me to Eastman School of Music for a two-week intensive music production course under Phil Ramone and Dave Green, who were close friends of his. But they saw something in me, I think, and they just kind of took me under their wings more so than the other members of the class in a way. You know, I got tons of time on the console. I got lots of feedback from those two guys, and they continued to help me after the course was over. And then Jack took me everywhere he went. I went on a plane with him. I was the advance guy. I'd work on the arrangements, and Jack would be there for the studio. But everywhere we went, whether it was a taxi, an airplane, sitting down for lunch, I had my little notebook, and I asked questions, like, all day. I must have driven him nuts, like, about everything, just like here. You know, was, okay, well, what's that? So a cardioid microphone, what does it look like? What does it do? Why do we use that?
Right.
On what instrument? And so on. And that was, and he was incredibly generous with this knowledge and his time. And in fact, he wanted me to be successful. He was taking great pride in grooming me.
He's still alive, right?
No, he passed away.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Oh, he did. Okay, but you stayed, I imagine, close with him throughout your entire career?
I stayed throughout my whole, you know, my whole life.
My whole life, right.
His whole life.
Right.
Yeah, and his son, Garth, is my partner in our school in Vancouver.
Who had a successful career producing a lot.
Has.
Not, yeah, but I know from records that he did back in, I said had because I know records he did back in the 80s. He did some hard rock records and records that I like very much because I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he spelled his first name with like 3 G. Or something like
because
that.
Because he has a stammer. Garth has a stutter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And it's notorious. And sometimes it's really profound. So instead of trying to hide from it,
I didn't know that.
He owned it, so he took it. Garth. Yeah.
Well, going and then moving into what you did, which of course was just your first production, was Alice Cooper. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Was it Love It to Death?
Yeah.
So
No. Actually, my first album production was Love It to Death.
The first thing you worked on that you got a credit on? The
first thing I worked on that I got a credit on was, I think, called Funky Sunflower by a band called Cat.
And what did you do on it? Did you produce it?
Yeah, I was co-producer. I think I got a credit. I have to go take a look. Well, because, you know, part of it was you just sort of did your job, right? You didn't know, by the way, when you rewrote half the song that was actually songwriting. You just thought that was kind of your job.
Right.
And you also didn't know that, you know, that people paid royalties or anything like that. I got a salary every week and I just sort of did my job. I didn't worry about credits or anything like that. I was having such a great time being in the studio with all these fantastic people and with Jack. I did, before that, I did some sound-alike commercials because the production company not only did rock record production, but we also did jingles.
But that's a big distinction as far as you making this decision to then go down this road as opposed to be the performer and be the guy that gets all the glory. And the other big thing about this is that you are known as this fantastic producer, which you are, but you're also an accomplished musician yourself and a songwriter. So when you would go in and work on some of these projects and want to help with the songs, I mean, some artists, I'm sure, would bristle at that. Like, well, we write the songs, the producer. But you're actually coming in and you're when you go into a project, you're going all in. You're going in to say, okay, if this needs a bridge, I'm going to write the bridge for this thing. Do you work that out ahead of time? Does an artist say to you, there's no way you're writing on my record, but I do want you to produce or do this?
I did have that. I had that with Roger Waters on the wall, where he basically said, not that there's no way you're writing. He says, I'm just not paying you any publishing on this record. He said, you can write all you want. You're not getting paid for it. And I said, okay, that's fine.
So did you write on that record?
Yes.
You did?
Yes, but, the trial, that song, which ends the record pretty much, the trial, I came up with the verse and chorus on that by myself, and I brought it in and said to Roger, you can't have this unless I'm a co-writer. And he went, oh, right then.
So do you have credit on the trial?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you do?
Yeah, yeah. It's two writers. It's him and me.
Wow,
and,
okay.
And on some of the other stuff I don't take over. It's like what you said, well, this needs a bridge. I'm going to write it. But usually, in the process of working on the song, I spend a lot of time on pre-production with the people that I work with, because for me, that preparation is 90% of the job. But at that moment that you realize you have a bridge problem, then you all get together and you try to work on it. If you can't do it as a team, or if the person whose song it is can't come in with a good idea, then I'll sort of take the reins and provide. And I think that, it's understood when I get brought into a project that I'm not a button pusher. I wasn't an engineer, really. I was a music guy who happened to learn a little bit about how all this works. And so I always say to people at the very beginning, if you're looking for a great engineer to sit there and capture your performance and that's all, I'm not the right guy.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can't keep my mouth shut.
Right, right.
But if you're looking for somebody who's going to help you to realize whatever dream it is that you have for this thing, or even help you to articulate the dream in the first place, to define what that dream is and then to be able to get there, if you're looking for that, that's what I love to do.
We're talking live with Bob Ezrin, but I want to continue going through your career, and I want to pick it up when we come back from the break with Alice and with Love It to Death, and how he came on your radar and what that experience was like actually taking the reins and fully producing your first official record. So we'll continue, and we'll talk some Alice, we'll talk some Kiss, we'll talk some Pink Floyd. Just so people know, too, because I did a little of my own homework, which I admit I don't usually do, because I like to think, where Bob likes to think he knows what goes on in the studio, I like to think as you said, Alice Cooper told you, Eddie's going to know more about you than you know.
Yes, that's what he said.
But I don't.
No, I checked you out, because before you asked if I would do a longer segment,
right,
after we had spoken before, and Alice was in the room.
Okay.
So I just went, do you know this guy? He goes, oh, yeah, he's great. He knows more about you than you do. I go, okay, right, I'll do the show.
Alice, the check is in the mail. Thank you, Alice. But I wanted to, and there's, I would just run down a few things that people may not know. First of all, Bob produced the brand new Deep Purple album, which comes out any day. But some of the other artists, just to give you an overview, and we'll pick it up coming back from the break. But everyone knows Kiss. Everyone knows Alice Cooper. Everybody knows Pink Floyd. Peter Gabriel, Fish, recent record by Fish, one of the biggest bands, the last two. Lou Reed, Berlin. You've done some work with the Bonham album, which I love, the first one, some great stuff there. There's a bunch of things that I want to touch on that people may not be aware. The Hollywood Vampires, Jane's Addiction, The Babies. I forgot. I didn't even realize The Babies. What a record that is. Hanoi Rocks, what many consider to be their great record. Mm. And Peter Gabriel. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So we'll get into some of that and a lot more with Bob Ezrin. Let's take a break right now. We'll come back. I want to pick it up with the emergence of the introduction of Bob as a producer on Alice Cooper's album Love It to Death. And we'll go from there.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Well, I've been telling you about Blue Apron for a while. It is a tremendous service. It really is. Not all ingredients are created equal. Fresh, high-quality ingredients, that's what makes a real difference. So it's important to know where your food comes from. And Blue Apron, take it from me, personal experience. It's great food. It's meals cooked the way you want to cook them. All the ingredients are right there. All the seasonings, everything you need. A handy recipe right on a great little card. You can hold on to it if you want to learn more and use it again. And even somebody like me who's not good in the kitchen, is not good at cooking, can make incredible, great tasting, high quality meals. All the ingredients are right in that box when it comes to your doorstep, a nice refrigerated box so everything stays nice and fresh. It really, really is great. It's affordable, less than $10 per person per meal. Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes. You can choose from a variety of new recipes every week. It's flexible. You can customize things. It's easy. It's guaranteed. Blue Apron guarantees their freshness. And they promise that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they'll make it right. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping. That's right. Three meals free with free shipping. All you got to do is go to blueapron.com/EddieTrunk. My name, EddieTrunk. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. blueapron.com/EddieTrunk. That's blueapron.com/EddieTrunk. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Live from Toronto today with Bob, talking about his amazing career, which we just mentioned started with the first album that he fully produced, Love It to Death by Alice Cooper. How did you meet? I mean, you still have a relationship with Alice. You're working with him now. You just worked with him in the studio. You did the Hollywood Vampires, a long, long history with Alice, going back to 71, I think, was that?
70.
70 was Love It to Death. How did you meet Alice? How did he come on your radar?
Alice Cooper, they played a famous festival here where he was supposed to have bitten the head off a chicken. That was that famous time, you know, and thrown the body into the audience. And no, he didn't. But they didn't make any money on this trip up here, and they couldn't pay their hotel bills, so they stayed. You know, like in the old days, if you can't pay your hotel bill, you just stay until you can find another gig. Anyway, their manager Shep Gordon was thinking about what they needed to get over to the next level. You know, their records were pretty eclectic, Easy Action and Pretty's For You. And
Were you aware of those records before?
Not at all. Okay. No. And somebody had said to him, or he came to his own conclusion, that Jack Richardson, the guy who does the Guess Who, might be the perfect guy to produce Alice Cooper. So they started on a campaign to get Jack to do it. And listen, Jack Richardson was in his early 40s, suit and tie guy, ex Erickson McCann, you know, ad agency man. He saw the pictures of these creatures of indeterminate sex with snakes, and they're wearing skirts and they got makeup. And he goes, no effing way, you know, I'm not doing it. Can we swear on your channel?
Yeah, you can.
Oh, we can. Okay, so he did, but actually, he would never have sworn. He wouldn't have said no fucking way. That's me,
right?
But he would have said no way, and so he just say to me, "Get rid of them. Get rid of them,
and make them go away.
Make them go away." So then, but to them, he would say, "Well, the kid's going to check them out. If the kid likes them, then I'll check them out. I'm the kid." So they were all over me. Finally, agreed to have me. See the band in New York. I got sent actually to sign someone else. And oh, by the way, at midnight that same night, go down to Max's Kansas City, see Alice Cooper play, and get rid of him. That was my job. So I went down to Max's Kansas City with my new friend, Alan Nichols, who was playing the lead in Hair, which at the time was the most cutting edge thing, you know, on stage, because there was full frontal nudity and it was anti-war. It was amazing. So this is like, he's a hippie. He's supposed to know. And I'm just this, you know, I am a hippie, like a true hippie. I had coveralls and, you know, and Birkenstocks or something. Anyways, we go down to Max's Kansas City and they play their show. Honest to God, it was one of the most astounding things I'd ever seen. And everybody in the joint had spider eyes and they were wearing spandex. They had black fingernails and jet black hair and black lipstick, and they knew all the words to all the songs. And we were right at the front of the stage. The band was like 3 feet away from us. They were so raw and full of kind of sexual ambivalence and violence and other kinds of energy, but some of the songs were also really cool. And by the time it was over, you know, I looked at him and he looked at me. I went, "What was that?" He said, "I don't know, but I think I liked it." And I said, "Well, I think I fucking loved it." And I went running up the stairs at Max's Kansas City to the dressing room without thinking. I just go running up the stairs, burst into their dressing room, and I went, "We'll do it. We will do it. We're gonna make a hit record with you guys. I'm telling you, we're gonna make hit records." And they go, "Great." And I go, "Great." And
they
didn't
say, "Wait, you're not Jack. Who are you?"
No, but they knew that I was there to be the one to say, you know, that Jack should check it out, right?
So,
like, they knew that if I liked the band, then Jack would go to the next stage. If I didn't like the band, it was over. I not only liked the band, I signed them. You know, I was like, "We'll do it." And then I go outside of Max's Kansas City, and I'm walking down the street. I'm high as a kite, like, on the energy of all this. And as it all dawned on me for a second, I stopped, and I looked at my feet, and I went, "I am so fired." Oh my God, what did I just do? So then I had to get back to Toronto, and I called Jack's partner, the one who picked me out of the musical, and said, "You know, I think I've done a terrible thing." Ooh, look, sirens.
Yeah, there's not, we're facing glass right off the street here, so you are hearing road noise. We're not in a soundproof studio.
This is really close to us. They're coming for us.
Yeah, exactly.
Somebody's been listening. Anyway, so I called Alan and I said, "Oh my God, I think I made a terrible mistake." And he said, "You get your ass on the next plane back to Toronto." So I did, and I was rehearsing in my head what I was going to say, and I burst into Nimbus 9 into the office, went bursting in Jack's office, and I went, "You don't understand. This wasn't rock and roll. There were no t-shirts. There were no jeans. They had lights and sets and everything. Everybody had spiders. They had spandex. They all had black lipstick. This wasn't just plain rock. This was the beginning of a cultural movement." And Jack was, you know, and I stood up on his desk. Like, I got up on his desk to yell at him, and he finally said, "Stop." He said, "Enough already. If you like it so damn much, you do it." And that was the beginning of my career.
And was that, did you have to sell that to the band? Because
yeah, we didn't tell them. So the first thing we did, well, we lied to them and we said, "Okay, well, Bob's going to do the pre-production. Jack will be there soon." It was like Waiting for Godot. I don't know if you know the play. So I go down to Pontiac, Michigan to work with Alice Cooper. And but we, you know, luckily we bonded in a big way.
Yeah.
And I've told the story a million times, but it's probably worth repeating just because it was such a great experience and so formative and in a way set the tone for how everything else in my life has gone since then. But so I got an address for these guys. I drive up to their place. And in Pontiac, Michigan, I'd stayed at a Motel 6 the night before, you know. I didn't want to take my clothes off to sleep. And I go there in my own car, and there's nothing down this street except a boarded up farmhouse. And this can't be it. But I decide there's nothing else here. So I go around the back of the boarded up farmhouse and stop the car, and staring at me outside my window is a three-legged dog. Like,
like something out of a movie.
No, this is beyond a movie. So I go, "Nice doggy, nice doggy." I open the car door and I sort of slink around to the other side, and the dog's like, on his three legs. And then I go to the back door, which is swinging open. In the breeze, you know, it's like Last Picture Show or something. And it's open. So I go in and I it's a little darker than outside. I get my bearings and I can see to the right of me, it's the kitchen. And there's like a sink full of filthy dishes and stuff. And there's a casserole on the counter that's a science experiment. There's unknown creatures growing out of this thing and everything. So I quickly go around the corner from there through a beaded curtain into a dark room. I reach to the wall for a light switch. And instead of gathering a switch, I have my hand on a cock and balls that I look at, and it's wearing glasses and has a cigar sticking out. It's a, you know, fake cock and balls. And I'm like, "Wah!" You know, and I jump from there.
Like a haunted house.
No, yeah, but it was unbelievable. I look at the bed. Now there's two creatures in the bed, and I don't know what they are, but one of them has braided mutton chops, and they're both wearing Dr. Denton's. But they both have just a shower of blonde, of matted blonde hair, right? So there's two blondes in bed in Dr. Denton's, and one of them's got braided mutton chops. I say, "I'm getting out of this room." So I go. There's another beaded curtain, which I exit through, and as I part the curtain, I'm standing face to, I don't know what, with a 6.5-foot frog. It's
frog.
A guy wearing a frog head who looks at me, and what does he say?
"I'm Alice Cooper."
"Ribbit. Come on." I swear to you.
I almost fell off my chair.
"Ribbit." It's Dennis Dunaway. Now I found out later that this had to do with a dare that his, you know, he and his girlfriend had that until they made up, he was going to be a frog until she kissed him and all that stuff. But listen, I had just gotten there. You know, I didn't know any of this stuff.
This is going to be
fun. He goes, ribbit, and he turns around and walks away. That's it. So I'm standing there looking at an empty room, and I hear beside me to the left, I hear. And I look over, and there's a green monkey. Seriously. Jerking off. Looking at me and jerking off. He's just like,
somebody in a monkey suit.
No, a real monkey in a cage, and he's green. It's a real spider monkey in a cage.
Holy
and I
shit.
Jump back from that. I go, woo! You know, and then finally I go, hello? Is there anybody human here? You know, and the door opens, and this kind of hippie-ish guy, their road manager comes out scratching his head. It's the crack of two. By the way,
2 a.m.
2 in the afternoon.
2 in the afternoon.
Yeah. And he comes out, Mike Roswell, and he goes, oh, man, sorry, we partied hard last night. But he's still sleeping. He said, I'll get the guys up. And that was how it started.
Wow. What an introduction to the world of Alice Cooper, which would lead you to do, you know, Love It to Death and School's Out and Billion Dollar Babies and Welcome to My Nightmare. And as I mentioned, recent records as well, including Hollywood Vampires Now. And, you know, a relationship that, I mean, it's got to be special. I mean, that's incredibly rare for anybody to have that sort of relationship with the band for that consistently. And Alice seems like that. I mean, I know Alice and he's a wonderful person and he seems like that sort of guy. You mentioned his manager, Shep. I mean, he was even there back then and he's still Alice's manager.
Yeah.
Like there's a certain loyalty there, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of loyalty.
Yeah.
And it is very familial. You know, I think of Shep and Alice both as brothers, you know, brothers from other mothers. And we've never lost our relationship. There were periods of time when I got busy with other stuff, or also there were eras in Alice's life, which he talks about, where he was into drinking and sometimes some drugs. And during those periods of difficulty, he hid from me because I would have seen it and I would have called it.
Right.
But mostly we've stayed in touch. And in fact, we were talking earlier today about the Music Hall of Fame here in Canada, which inducted me in 2004. And my wife was calling around to just get people to do videos and all that other stuff. And she called Alice and said, would you think about maybe presenting the award? He said, I wouldn't let anyone else do it.
Yeah.
And he was like, there. So that's a relationship I cherish and one that will keep going for the rest of my life, I hope.
And When you were on the show not too long ago, we had you on briefly just talking about Kiss Destroyer, which was the first record you did for them the first of three. When you worked with Kiss and you came into that for Destroyer, I imagine Kiss admittedly being influenced and fans of Alice, I imagine that they, because you had already had such a great track record with Alice, that sort of played into their interest in working with you. Would I be right in that? Was that a conscious thing? Was that discussed at all? That, well, you know, what you did with Alice on this record, that sort of stuff come up?
No, we didn't talk. No. And that rarely happens, by the way, where somebody says, well, I want to work with you because that sound you got on that song over there, that's what I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm.
I think that most of the time it's just because they enjoy something that I was involved with and they want to meet. And then we either click or we don't click. And in the case of the Kiss guys, we clicked beautifully. You know, we were right on the same page very early on in discussion. But how I met them was here, actually, in Toronto. I was doing an interview on City TV. They had a rock interview show, or music interview show, rather. And as I was going up the stairway to go to the studio, they were coming down in full regalia. And I had been, as I told you, called by this young man here, Mike Longmans, who was a 16-year-old kid, my number was in the phone book. So he used to just call me and say, you know who's really cool, man? This one is really cool. So he had told me about Kiss and said, they need you. They need you to produce their records. And honestly, I hadn't even heard them. I didn't know. But I ran into him like, you know, he said it on a Wednesday and Friday I bumped into him.
Yeah, what an irony.
Incredible irony. So I said, being the punk that I am, to Paul Stanley, are you happy with your records? And he goes, yeah, why? I go, well, If you're ever not, call me. And that was that. And then some months later, I got that call.
Which, of course, was, I mean, at the time they may have been, but in retrospect is a lie because they've talked about not a lie, but not true, because they've talked about many times for decades now in interviews that they felt that those first three studio records that they made didn't capture the essence of what they were in any way, and that they struggled with those getting the sound they wanted.
It's easy to say those things in hindsight, and right. I think a lot of the time, you know, when you're making stuff, you're so into the process and so into the stuff itself that you don't really know how you feel about it until you've had a little distance, right? So at that time, you know, they were just coming up. People were really paying a lot of attention to them, and they were excited about themselves. And here's a guy that they never met before. They knew my name because of Alice Cooper. I said, I'm Bob Ezrin. They go, okay, we know who you are. And I said, well, I know who you are, and are you happy with your records? And that was a little bit of a challenge.
Right. And they were coming off of finally breaking. I mean, they had finally just broken with the live record with Kiss Alive. Couple quick more things on Kiss. We talked about Destroyer when you were on this show. Well, that's what you called in about. We talked about it. I did not realize until I read this book that came out recently, which you were interviewed in, called Shout It Out Loud, about the making of Destroyer.
Yeah.
Because Destroyer was my first Kiss record. It was my introduction to the band. It was a game-changing record for me as a kid. But I didn't realize that there was a substantial backlash to that record when it initially came out, because it was so light years different than what they had done before in a production right. standpoint. How did you handle that at the time? Because you were the guy behind the whole thing. I mean, in the book, it even says that there was talk of them possibly even pulling the record at one point. Is that true?
Yeah. Well, I don't know about them pulling the record, because I think the record company recognized that they had something to play with. But the band was not happy, and the management were not happy. I mean, they were very, as I said, when you're making something, you love it. And the band was extremely happy with the process, and they were doing things that they'd never done before in the studio. They were playing better than they'd ever played before. And that's them playing, by the way. I know, you know, Dick Wagner played a couple of solos, but aside from that, I mean, that's that rhythm section. And Stanley sang his ass off. I mean, it was really, they really outshone themselves.
Yeah.
Right? So they loved the doing of it. They were very proud of it. But as soon as it started to go to some of the older fans or some of the people that they had known from before, there was a backlash because it was so different. And then they began to doubt, because that's what happens when you're a performer. And before you hear the applause, in between the finishing of a performance and hearing the applause, it is the nature of the performer to go to a doubtful place. Mm. Which is one of the reasons why when I'm working in the studio, I say to engineers, young producers, anybody, the minute they stop playing, I get on the talk back. I leave no time for them to stand in the dark wondering how they did. Do you know what I mean? Because that's a terrible thing to do to somebody. You know, it's the same thing as if a play would end and nobody applauded. You know, the cast would be standing there going, uh-oh. And then it erupts, and then they go, wow, we were great. So anyway, you know, there was that period of time where they were allowed to doubt themselves. And then some of the people that knew them, and one review in particular, really reamed us for the stuff that we had done. One guy called it Anne Margaret Horns, and how he wanted to come up to Toronto and punch me in the nose on behalf of Kiss fans everywhere. Wow. Literally in the review.
Right.
And then I went away on vacation after having delivered the thing. And when I got back, I was living in New York at the time, and I had an answering service in the days when you had ladies answering your phone for
right.
you. And I got back from our vacation, and the lady from the answering service says, where have you been? I said, well, I've been on vacation. She said, Mr. Douglas has been calling you and calling you, and you'd better call him because he seems very, very upset. So it's okay. I called Jack Douglas, and he said, look, I don't know how to deal with this, and I'll do whatever you tell me to do, but I got a call from Bill O'Coin asking me if I would be willing to do the next Kiss album.
Wow. Now, wow. Jack Douglas worked under you.
He started off as an assistant engineer, then became an engineer, and then I started his career as a producer.
And for people that don't know, because not everybody's as into this stuff as you and I are, Jack Douglas is what he's best known for is doing all the classic Aerosmith records. Also worked with John Lennon and all these icons. But I think you turned your mic off, Bob, by accident. But the Aerosmith the Aerosmith records, which Jack did their most recent one, as a matter of fact.
I actually did that on purpose. I was kind of hoping to sneak out of the... you caught me, Eddie. Eddie caught me. Okay, carry on. Yes, Jack Douglas.
So
yes.
He was, much like Jack Richardson brought you
very
under...
Very much like Jack Richardson brought me under... And it's exactly how... That was exactly the relationship that Douglas and I had, where I said, you know, look, I'm going to bring you along. And then at a certain point, just like Jack, I let him fly. I said, you know, I'm not going to hold you up here. I don't want you to be an indentured servant to me. Here's your career, and here's Aerosmith.
So was Jack... Well, see, there's so much to talk about. This is why we'll get to the... Jack Douglas, just backtracking a second... produced Aerosmith's Get Your Wings, their second record. You were executive producer on that record, correct?
They'd asked me to produce it. I was in the studio, you know, I don't know if the dates line up. In my head, it's because I was working with Kiss. Might have been Alice Cooper. I don't know what it was at that moment, but I couldn't go in when they wanted me to go in. And also, I wasn't sure how long Steven would last with me. Because I'm just so intolerant of bullshit, you know. And there, at that time, he was very much a prima donna. And
even then, because they hadn't really broken yet, second album. But even then,
but
he's huh?
always been. And you know, that's part of his charm, too. I mean, part of what makes him Steven is just his larger-than-life personality. And
right.
he is a prima donna. He'll be the first person to tell you about it. But I thought Jack, who had a... Jack's a much more even kind of, even-tempered, quiet sort of guy, and I thought that he might be a much better day-to-day person to be in the studio with Aerosmith, but I'd be the executive producer. I'd watch over the project, and so it took some convincing, but they allowed us to do that, and then they had such a great time with him. They loved it, and it was time to do the next one, but I had them signed. I had the production deal with Aerosmith, and I took Jack for a ride around the park one day in a car and just said, you need to go out on your own. You need to...
fly.
Yeah. You need to stop taking a salary from the record plant. You need to stop taking a salary from me. You need to become your own guy. And here's Aerosmith. You've graduated. Congratulations and best of luck. So off he went.
So back to Kiss. You would do Destroyer. I don't mean to gloss over Destroyer, but there's so many things we need to get to here. You would work with Kiss again... about 6 years later, on an album that is incredibly polarizing to the Kiss fan base. There are some that feel that it is this undiscovered gem and this record that nobody understands, that's a masterpiece. And there's others, including the band at this point, Gene and Paul especially over the years, who've said they just think it's a pile of rubbish and something they shouldn't have done. You have very conflicting viewpoints on music from The Elder. Your take on the record in retrospect?
Well, you know, I used to say about it that it would, you know, we should have been shot before we were allowed to do it, or, you know, I was very denigrating, but I hadn't listened to it in forever. I hadn't listened to it since way, way, way back. So they were doing a book about it, the authors of which are on my permanent personal shit list for the rest of their lives, because they got me into such hot water with Paul Stanley that he and I don't talk to each other anymore, which breaks my heart. But
What did they say that was erroneous that you wrote in the book?
It's not in the book, and it was a sort of off the record remark at a time when I was sort of pissed off about Paul's biography and some of the stuff he was saying about Gene. And anyway, it got back to him, and that was the end of that. But
he's a sensitive man. I know firsthand.
He's a very sensitive man. But in the process of talking to these people, they were playing the songs to me again. I hadn't heard them in so long. And there are moments of – there are really brilliant musical moments on that record. There are also cringeworthy, embarrassing – moments, particularly for Paul. I feel the worst for Paul after listening back to the record, because he was forced into a position where he had to be almost operatic. And in a way, it's almost, you know, this was a little bit of foreshadow for him doing the Phantom of the Opera, by the way. The Paul Stanley, who played the Phantom, up here, he did 9 months as the Phantom of the Opera in Toronto, and sold out the whole run. he was amazing. He was brilliant. But that was the same guy who sang on The Elder. It was a very operatic, you know, musical theater voice and so on. It just didn't belong. And it didn't belong to Kiss. And I think it must have put him in a terrible position. But it wasn't like we forced him. He bought into the concept. So did Gene. We were all really into the concept except for Ace, who felt it was not rock. It wasn't right. And he didn't really want to have much to do with it. And anyway, at the end
of
the
day, Eric Carr's a brand new guy at that point, so he doesn't have a voice.
He was a brand new guy, but he loved what he was playing. So look, you know, you go back and there are some, as I say, there are some moments on there when they were playing stuff for me, I was listening and going, wow, that's sophisticated. That's really amazing music. And then every once in a while I was saying, oh my God, you know, I can't believe I did that.
Yeah. In the interest of time moving forward, I want to just hit a few other things. We'll go to a break. The phones are jammed. We'll let you fire away at Bob Ezrin as well. You would do one more album with Kiss, which was Revenge, which is heralded by many as a great record. Many do love that record. Fans do. The band themselves have put that. A lot of times when I read interviews with Gene or Paul, they ask about the three definitive Kiss records, and you produced two of them, which would be Destroyer. They cite Revenge and also Creatures of the Night, which you were not involved in. But Revenge, a better experience for you? Was it getting back to more of a meat and potatoes approach for Kiss?
Yeah. Well, listen, Revenge was Revenge came out of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, where we got back together to do God Gave Rock and Roll to You. And that, you know, just being in the studio doing that reminded us that we actually love each other. And, you know, The Elder aside, you know, we should be working together. We should be in the studio together. So then we did the album, and because the makeup was off and the album, it was a Kiss album, but it was a Kiss rock album, like really
heavy rock. Yeah.
Rock.
Yeah.
And I love heavy rock. I mean, that's what moves me more than anything except for maybe heavy metal classical, which I love, you know.
Two cellos you did, right?
Yeah, that's not heavy metal classical. When I'm talking about things like
Real classical
Tchaikovsky,
pieces, right?
You know, some of that stuff is the heaviest of heavy.
Right.
But so I really loved doing the record, and we had some great songs. But for me, the highlight of the record was knowing that the number one song in strip clubs across America...
Take It Off.
Take It Off, and number two was Domino. So I had one and two on the strip the strip club top
I think
10.
Didn't Kane Roberts co-write Take It Off? I think he did.
Did he? I don't remember.
Yeah, I believe he did, because I just met Kane for the first time recently, but I think he did. All right, so again, we can go to Kiss, we can go to Alice Cooper, we can go to any of the amazing records. As I mentioned before, the list goes on and on with Bob and some of the... I realize I'm not hitting everything here. We just don't have the time, and I want to give you guys, as I promised, a good part of the show to call in with your questions. But before we go to the phones the rest of the way... And I take this break.
He's teasing you, isn't he?
I'm just setting it up. I'm trying to give everybody the lay of the land. Bob, there's too much to talk about. We need to do a week together. Pink Floyd, how do they come on your radar? You, of course, the first thing you would do for them, and not the only, but the first, you would do The Wall.
Okay, let me tell you how they came on my radar. Alice Cooper were the biggest Pink Floyd fans in the early days. Like when I first went to work with them in Pontiac, Michigan, they played me T-Rex and Pink Floyd. They loved them.
See, that would be surprising to me right there, because I don't know if I get the... I would think of Alice Cooper as being like more of a garagey sort of loose band for some reason back then, as opposed to being into these, you know, this sort of, you know, I don't know.
Alice Cooper was an art band.
Yeah.
And they're all art students. And Pink Floyd were all art students. And they were an art band. It was just a different kind of art from a different time.
Yep.
But when we went on the road, and I say we because in those days I used to travel with the band a lot. I actually played with them for a while until my wife kind of bottom lined it for me. But
I can't imagine why.
But we were on the road promoting I'm 18, the single. They asked me to come along. So we would go to radio stations around. And the first question a DJ would ask you after talking about the record and playing your record is, what are you listening to? So I like to credit Alice with spreading the gospel on Pink Floyd around the FMers in America. It was really remarkable. Like, a lot of these people had never heard of the band. And they would put something on from Saucer, Full of Secrets, or Adam Hartmother, and they would go, wow, you know. I can't remember if it was Adam Hartmother in those days or not. But so that's how I knew about him. Dark Side of the Moon was a transformative experience for me, listening experience, and made me really think about what I was doing, and made me jealous. You know, there's a whole long list of records that made me jealous. That one made me really jealous. and then I met Roger at a party in London, and the woman who became his wife, Caroline, his first wife, actually worked for me in London.
Okay.
So, and when she started to date Roger, she wanted us to meet. And then when on the Animals tour, when Roger was lamenting having to be the guy all the time and was thinking that, you know, he'd like someone to work with the band, Caroline engineered us getting together. We rode actually from here, Toronto to Hamilton, Ivor Wynne Stadium, where they blew up the scoreboard at the end of the show with their pyro. But we drove out to Hamilton, and that's where he said, "I often feel like just putting up a wall between us and the audience because I can't stand it anymore." And he said, "And I feel bad about it, but I found myself spitting at somebody," you know, it was that sort of thing, right? And then on the way back, we kept noodling on that, and I said, you know, well, if you ever decide you want to build a wall and stuff, you know, like, call me. I'd love to help you. A year later, I got the call.
Going into they're coming off of Animals, right? That was the previous record.
Yes.
And you're going into this, and then you get Roger, I'm sure, gives you the concept and tells you what the story is going
to
be?
Well, he invited me to his house in the country, and where little Harry was walking around. Going, "Look, Daddy, in the sky. Is that an airplane?" And we said, "Record that." No, I'm kidding. But he was that was little Harry who said that on the record, who's now a musician in his own right, very talented guy. And But anyway, I went to Roger's house because he wanted to play me what he had been working on, and it was two different projects. One became Radio Chaos, and the other one became The Wall. And he played me these two things. There was lots of material for the Radio Chaos, maybe it was something else. What was the other one? The other solo?
Pros and Cons.
Pros and Cons. Sorry, that's what it was. It was Pros and Cons. And sorry, brain fart. And then he played me this 45-minute long song that went da 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 da, and it talked about how Daddy was in the war and Daddy died, and then I was really sad, and then I was a rock star, and then I wasn't a rock star, and then I did. But there were moments of absolute genius, like "Mother, do you think they'll drop the bomb?" I mean, stuff that like made the hair on my arm stand up, you know. And even I don't think we had another Brick in the Wall Part Two yet. But there were just these like brilliant moments, and the atmosphere of it was so thick and compelling and hypnotic and everything. So when he said to me, "Well, which of these two do you like?" And I said, "Well, that one, The Wall, that one, that's the thing we should work on." And of course the band had gone through the same exercise with him, listening to both, and they picked The Wall. So there we were.
Listen, I mean, for people that don't know, Momentary Lapse of Reason, Division Bell, you're a co-writer of the song Learning to Fly. There's so much with Pink Floyd as well that Bob is
I loved working with them too, and I remain really good friends with David Gilmour and Nick Mason. Both, I loved Rick Wright. He was a dear friend, and I saw him a month before he passed away, and Roger and I sort of had a falling out over, as everyone knows publicly, over me going with the other Pink Floyd, right, in his head and not sticking with him.
Right.
But nonetheless, we still have a deep mutual affection and admiration. And that was a great time.
Last thing for me before I turn, I promise the calls the rest of the way. When you're working on a Kiss Destroyer, Alice Cooper, Welcome to My Nightmare, Pink Floyd, The Wall, when you're in it, when you're making it, do those records, does it connect with, does it hit you at some point that what you are making is going to be, I mean, I know you feel probably strongly about a lot of the records you worked on, but when you're making those sort of records, Billion Dollar Babies, does it strike you that these are going to be defining records in these artists' career, that you're really doing something extraordinary at the time?
Yeah, I didn't really. I would say in the first decade of my career, I probably didn't know what I was sitting on most of the time, though I got particularly excited about certain bits and pieces. You know, I was excited about Billion Dollar Babies for Hello Hooray, pardon me, and for a couple of other things that were on that record that I thought were, you know, and the song itself, Billion Dollar Babies, that I thought were just really amazing. But with The Wall, you know, we were so busy in the trenches building this wall, Mr. Trunk's wall. We were so busy in the trenches building the wall, brick by brick, song by song, part by part, that only when we finally stood back and played it end to end, which I did once in my rental house on Kings Road in Los Angeles to impress someone. It was a girl. Of course it was.
That's a hell of a move. Hey, let me play you this record I produced. Yeah. And it's The Wall.
Anyway. Well, you know, she didn't know.
If that doesn't get you laid, I don't know what will. Holy shit.
Well, no, I wasn't getting laid, but I was just trying to be, I was just trying to be a stud, you know, I just wanted to be.
As I would have been too in that situation.
I was already dating somebody in Toronto that I had, you know, that I was deeply in love with and who I ended up marrying and having my daughter Sarah with and all that sort of stuff. So this was just to be, I was just showing off.
All right. Yeah.
I was just showing off.
Why
and
not?
I'm glad, like, hey. Well, yeah, I wanted to hear it. I wanted to hear it, and I wanted to listen to it through somebody else's ears, and I was scared to play it for anybody that in the business because I didn't want word to travel. But when you hear something with someone else's ears, you really know what you got, you know, or most of the time you do. So anyway, I put it on and played it from top to bottom on Kings Road in L.A. when, you know, it was like a late afternoon, and as the sun was going down, the trial came on, you know, and it was, we're just getting to the end of the thing, and then it goes around full circle and is about to start up again. And honestly, like, I didn't even care that there was somebody else in the room. I was just sitting there. I had tears in my eyes, and I was staring at the wall where all these people, the wall of the room, where all these people had just been, you know, playing and singing and performing and doing all this stuff in this eyelid movie that they just gave me, you know. And I thought, holy shit, this is big.
Yeah. Bob Ezrin is my guest. We got to take a break. I promise you guys on the phones, the rest of the show is yours. Enough from me. I could go on forever. There's so much we haven't even begun to touch on, but I'll let you steer the conversation. We'll try to move quickly so we can get as many calls in as possible with Bob Ezrin. Break, coming back with your calls next. Stick around.
The Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Audible, folks, you got to try it. You know, as you guys are listening to this podcast, if you're listening to it on the post day, I am in the middle of a 5-hour drive headed to Columbia, Maryland, where I will host the M3 Festival this weekend. And what makes time go by better in the car than listening to a book? Now, you certainly can't read a book if you're sane in any way. You don't try to read a book while you're driving, right? There's so many ways you can take in books now. And who has the time, really, to sit down and read them all the time? Sometimes it's great to listen to them, and that's where Audible comes into play. It really is an awesome service, and Audible is now offering a 30-day free trial, complete with a credit for a free audiobook download. It really is awesome. Get a free audiobook download, 30-day free trial. All you got to do is go to audible.com/trunk, T-R-U-N-K. Over 180,000 titles to choose from. So many different devices, including iPhone, Android, Kindle, even an MP3 player. So many great titles. Divergent, Lean In, The Book Thief, The Girl on the Train, a novel, The Hobbit. Just a few of the titles you can get via Audible. And like I said, you can download a free audiobook, get a free 30-day trial. All you got to do, go to audible.com/trunk. Again, that's audible.com/trunk for your free audiobook.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
All right, let's get Jay in Texas. He's been waiting almost an hour and a half to talk to you, Bob.
Ooh,
so, Jay, thank you for your patience. You're finally on with Bob Ezrin. Go ahead, buddy.
Hey, great show today. You answered pretty much my question in regards to the elder with the overview, but I do have one quick question in regards to that. Do you think that because of the commercial failure of the elder, and even though they toured with makeup and they had a very abbreviated tour with Creatures of the Night, do you think that that failure of the elder contributed to any of the taking of the makeup off to get them back into the mainstream? And before you answer that, Bob, I saw just recently that you were the co-founder for Music Rising in New Orleans, and I'm a New Orleans native, so I see firsthand the charitable foundation that began with Music Rising. I was at that Saints game for the return to the Superdome.
Were you? Wasn't that amazing?
It was a riveting performance by U2 and Green Day, and especially, which is now a theme song for the Saints called The Saints Are Coming. How did that all germinate and come to fruition? Thank you very much.
Okay, so I'm really happy to talk about that, actually, my sons came for that, which was fantastic. It made it even a better experience. We established this charity to replace the musical instruments that were washed away or destroyed in the flooding in New Orleans. We figured that was the least political way of dealing with bringing New Orleans back to life. Mm-hmm. Because where there was music, there was hope, there was optimism, there was a sense of community, and there was the soul of New Orleans. And where there wasn't music, people just seemed desperate and resigned to, you know, a terrible, dark existence. So The Edge, Henry Juskowitz, who is the head of Gibson Musical Instruments, and Marty Albertson, who ran Guitar Center, and I got together, and we raised, Henry and Marty raised over $1 million, and The Edge and I went out and raised millions more. And we replaced instruments for 2,700 professional musicians for 60-some-odd churches and community centers and schools. And one year after the flooding, we also, to raise some money for Music Rising, we did the pregame show for the Saints' first home game back in the Superdome, mm-hmm. where just a year before people had been dying in the stands, right? And they played the Atlanta Falcons, another game the Falcons would really love to forget. But so we did 12 and a half minutes where we had Green Day and U2 together. And Edge found this little punk song called The Saints Are Coming and played it for me. He said, you know, I think this would really work, you know. And I'm listening to it going, holy crap, it's like this was written for this day, you know. So that became the pivotal moment within that presentation. And then it ended up with Beautiful Day where they hit the audience with tons of light, and Bono talked about, you know, New Orleans and how we're all people too. And it was so moving. At the end of this whole 12 and a half minutes, there wasn't one person in that building that wasn't on their feet with their fist in the air and tears streaming down their cheeks. One of the most emotional moments of my life.
Of all the bands that you've worked with, there's obviously some you haven't. If Bob Ezrin today could pick one band to work with that you never have, who would it be?
You mean that still exists?
Yeah. If you could work with a band today, give me one that doesn't exist and one that does. I mean, if you could go back in the time machine.
Yeah. You know what? Listen, I'm happy with my life. I love what I'm doing and everyone that I get to work with. There was a time when I really wished I could have worked with the Talking Heads. I thought that was just one of the most interesting, artful bands in the world. Mm-hmm. I would have loved that. I would have loved working with U2 and because I love those boys and everything, but they have their way of doing things and their way and their place of doing things, and I have mine. And of course, I was a huge Beatles fan, but I got to work with Paul McCartney, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I'd say so.
But I got to sing with him. I got to stand next to him and sing.
Really?
Sing with Paul. Yeah, SERP, as we call him.
Another legendary artist that Tim in Florida wants to ask you about working with. Go ahead, Tim. You're on with Bob Ezrin.
On the kids, on Lou Reed's Berlin. That's your children crying.
Yes, Tim. It's my children crying. And you want to know what I use to beat them with to get those tears, right, Tim?
Nah.
What's the question?
You just wanted to know if they were Bob's kids on Lou Reed's Berlin?
Yeah.
Yeah, he confirmed that they are.
They are.
Thank you very much, Tim, for the phone call. Appreciate it. Let's talk to Ken, who's in Massachusetts. Hi, Ken. You're on with Bob Ezrin.
Hi. How you doing, guys? It's an honor to talk to both of you. And let me put a plug in for the best underrated Bob Ezrin album is The King's first album. That's a great
album. Wow. Were you listening to the beginning of the show?
I was, yes.
Yes. And I threw to Eddie the lyrics for Switching to Glide, and he didn't. I threw the ball, and he let
yeah.
It,
but I remember Switching to Glide. That's a great song. That's very power poppy, and I love power poppy sort of little new wavy power
yeah,
poppy
it was
sort
very
of thing.
New wavy,
yeah,
yes.
yeah,
Excellent. Yeah. Thanks. I love doing that record. I love those guys. I actually just saw them again not that long ago. They're still here, and they play from time to time. Yeah, there you go.
Go ahead, Ken. What's your question?
My question is, obviously, with the recent documentary and book that Shep Gordon put out, how about Bob Ezrin? I think we need to read a biography or see a documentary on Bob Ezrin.
Oh, boy. Well, I'm kind of busy.
you're still, I mean, Bob produced the new Deep Purple album that's about to come out. I mean, I don't know what else you're currently doing that you want to
Alice
share with
Cooper.
Us.
Yeah, we're finishing an Alice Cooper album.
You never slowed down from when you started way back in the day. I mean, you're
no, I never slowed down. I did do other things besides music production. You know, we had a new technology company, an interactive entertainment company in California called Seventh Level during the 90s. And then I had a company that was internet radio / social media called Enigma Digital, which we sold to Clear Channel in the early aughts. And but I was producing at the same time. I did Jane's Addiction and Deftones and, you know, a bunch of stuff out there and stuff here. And now here we have a children's entertainment company called Wow! Unlimited. It's actually kids and youth, and it's animation-centric. So we're working on that. I've got a couple of shows that I'm producing for the company as well as these, you know, as well as albums and stuff. It's a busy time.
So there's no time to write a book. You're not ruling it out doing it at some point.
No, but I'll tell you what. One of the reasons why I like to do this show, Eddie, was because I got to talk about some things that you're going to provide me with an MP3 copy of, right?
Yeah, of course.
So I have some backup.
Well, of course.
Some new background information for the book. At some point when I'm ready to slow down.
Let's take one final break here for the show, and then we'll come back. We'll continue with your calls, talking with Bob Ezrin on this week's Eddie Trunk Podcast.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Well, if you have a dog, you've got to check out BarkBox. BarkBox is a delivery of 4 to 6 natural treats and super fun toys curated around a surprise theme each month. For dogs, BarkBox is like the joy of a million belly scratches. You tell them how big your dog is, right? And then you choose a plan. 1, 6, or 12-month plans are available. You can cancel anytime, and there's free shipping. And then BarkBoxes are shipped on the 15th of each month. It really is a great service. Every month, BarkBox, they pick the best all-natural treats and innovative toys to match a dog's unique needs, including allergies, heavy chewer preferences, things like that. All of the edibles, they're made in the USA or Canada. 100% of the products are tested on their own animals. So it really is trustworthy stuff. BarkBox, it's a great way to try a variety of treats, keep your dog engaged, keep your dog excited. Toys, treats, the whole nine yards, you're going to love it. Free shipping on any BarkBox within the continental U.S. as well. So you got to check it out. BarkBox really is awesome. Here's the deal. You get a free extra month of BarkBox if you visit getbarkbox.com/trunk when you subscribe. A whole free month, ladies and gentlemen, of BarkBox. All you got to do is go to barkbox.com/trunk, T-R-U-N-K, and subscribe. Getbarkbox.com/trunk.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Jack in West Virginia has been waiting for a very long time.
Wow.
Thank you for doing so, Jack. You're on the air.
Hey, Mr. Ezrin, this has been a real treat today. I just got a couple quick questions, and I'll hang up. One, when you first met Alice and you fought to produce him, did you realize how big he was going to explode? I mean, he owned rock and roll. Those first five albums you guys did together, he was like the biggest thing in rock and roll for a few years there. Second question is, I'm sorry.
Do you want an answer to that one? Let me answer that one real quick. And
sure.
Did I realize? Yes, I really believed it. Like that stuff I said to Jack Richardson after I saw them in New York, I really believed this was the beginning of a cultural movement, and these guys would be at the forefront of it. Next.
Well, we're all lucky you picked up on that. Number two is you have a way of dragging out really good performances by musicians that are kind of limited. You know, Alice Cooper and Kiss are two of my five favorite bands. But, you know, that original band might not have been the virtuoso, Alice Cooper's band, and Kiss certainly weren't virtuosos in 75 and 76. But then again, you go work with people like Pink Floyd, who are all match-free musicians. Is it easier to work with someone like Pink Floyd, or is it easier to be in a studio with someone limitless that you can kind of beat in a submission like you did with the boys in Destroyer? Bob, it was a treat. Eddie, I'll see you.
Beat into submission.
That's very funny. Okay, well, first of all, don't put them down. Don't short sell those two bands. And, you know, in Pink Floyd, I mean, David Gilmour is one of the greatest guitar players of all time, ever in history. He goes into my top three. And
Who are the other two?
Well, Jimi Hendrix.
Okay, heard of him.
For sure, and Jimmy Page. I mean, those three guys. Oh, sorry, wait a minute. Wait. Well, hold it. Slide Hendrix down one. So we'll say top four. Jeff Beck.
Okay.
Maybe the greatest ever. So, but that's it. You know, like you get those guys and everything else, everything after that is kind of, But, you know, Nick Mason's not the world's greatest musician. And Roger Waters would tell you he wasn't a great bass player, but they wrote amazing stuff and they had a really phenomenal sense for what worked in a studio. Rick was a great keyboard player on certain things, but not, you know, perfect on other things. So I think every band has great strengths and some areas of relative weakness that need attention. But the idea is to, you know, try to play to those strengths, man. Try to find the strengths and play to them. The other thing is that sometimes people are afraid of reaching for their true potential. So one of the things my wife says about me, aside, you know, from that I'm a kid that never grew up, is that I have a tendency to see better in people than they see in themselves, which I, you know, actually I'll wear that. I'm proud of that. So I love to work with a musician and say, you hear that thing you just played there in those four bars? And they go, yeah. I go, like, that's fucking genius. Listen to that. And all we need to do is get everything else up to that level. So let's go for it. You know,
who was the musician you worked with that most surprised you, that most upped their game in the studio, that most took, you said, whoa, I didn't see that coming. I didn't know this guy was capable of this. Was there somebody that really floored you that you didn't see coming?
You know, because I make it such a business of studying the people that I'm about to work with, I don't usually get taken by surprise. You know, I would say for all I pushed the shit out of him, I think Peter Criss stepped up beyond what anyone expected him to be able to do and played his ass off.
Yeah, on Destroyer. It's unbelievable.
It's great.
Yeah, it's a great
the drumming
track.
On that. When I got to remix that thing and started listening to him again, you know, I know he complained. And I know that I set the parts for him in a way that made it possible for him to succeed, that didn't put him in a position where he was going to fail. But nonetheless, he played them. And it's great.
Yeah, it is. Let's go to Benji, who's in North Carolina. Hi, Benji. You're speaking with Bob Ezrin on Trunk Nation. What's going on today?
Where in North Carolina,
hey,
Benji?
Bob. I'm in Greensboro.
Well, guess what? And I knew that. I just had a sense. So my daughter, Sarah, went to Greensboro College and then UNCG. I've spent a lot of time in your town.
Oh, shut up. You're never going to believe this, dude. I am actually a local engineer and producer, and I'm doing a talk at Greensboro College tomorrow night.
Good. Well, say hi from the Ezrins.
So great, man. I just got finished with a gig with a PhD professor who is a keys player from Greensboro College also. Literally an hour and a half ago, we just finished the gig. So that's so crazy,
good.
Man.
Great.
Unbelievable.
What's your question?
Anyway, so quickly, two things. Please tell me that those are bass keys on a piano that I hear in Detroit Rock City.
Yeah, I do that all the time.
Is that you playing them?
Yeah, I used to do that all the time. I, you know, actually, now that you mention it,
I probably should have done it some on this Alice album. Maybe I should go back and re-record. Wait a minute.
I used to
do that all the time, and especially when I was working with bass players who were more about power than finesse or technique. You know, I shouldn't say, you know, I don't mean that in a pejorative way. I just mean, you know, not a lot of notes, but big, fat bass notes. In order to fatten up even more, I would double them with the left hand of the piano. Yes.
There you go, Benji.
One more quick thing.
Real quick.
With today being such a singles-based music market and you being a concept, known as a concept record producer, has that affected the way that you would go about any new project at all?
No.
Thank you, Benji, for the call. I mean, that's a whole other discussion, too, is where we are now in the music industry and the pros and cons of it versus when you first started.
I'm not in the music industry. I'm really not. Mm-hmm. I'm not a part of it. I don't hang out. I don't talk to the...
But I'm just talking about the technology, and we talked off the air. I hate the fact that everything is so slammed and compressed and everything today by a lot of guys.
Okay, we agree on that.
The volume wars and all that sort of thing.
But the, you know, where I live, I by sort of definition, and we make stuff, it goes out in the world, people pay for it, so it's music business in that sense. But I want to work with people who are making music for their fans and who are making music for themselves, not for some record company executive or to some formula or anything like that. And thank God, after all this time, I don't really have to do that. I don't have to play that game, and I'd rather not. So I get to work with people like Fish. You know, they don't give a shit what the industry's doing. Right. They play, they're Fish, and they are who they are. They play and they write and they perform brilliantly. They're smart, they're talented, they're consummate musicians, unbelievable musicians. And the same thing with Deep Purple. You look at those, every single one of them is a virtuoso on a certain level. And they know their fans, they want to play for their fans. And my job is to help them to reach a level that they hadn't even thought about before. And they do it. Because I can see the talent and I see the potential in all of them. And Alice Cooper's the same way. He's a consummate writer, performer, amazing guy. He knows, he just knows his audience, and he wants to make music for them. You know, the good news is none of us have to compete at pop radio. So I don't play by those rules.
Right. Matt in Alabama. Go ahead, Matt. You're on with Bob Ezrin.
Hey, guys, how are you?
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Matt.
Where in Alabama are you?
I'm in Huntsville.
Oh, cool. I've been there.
About 2 hours south of you when you're in Nashville.
I know exactly where you are.
Yep. Question for you. You just mentioned the Deep Purple record, so you're working with Steve Morse again.
Yes.
I remember when In the Spirit of Things came out, the Kansas record, and the band was doing a big mass interview, and they were just talking about how great Steve played and how great he wrote, and the host made a comment about, boy, yeah, you know, what I heard was great. And then the band member said, if you think what you heard was great, you should have heard some of the stuff that wound up on the cutting room floor. Is that typical, and is some of that stuff just really good but didn't work with the project or wouldn't have been received by...
No, I think what they were referring to, I don't remember that specific interview, but what I think what they were referring to in Morse's case is, like, he never stopped playing. Like, didn't matter if the rest of the band was playing or not, he just kept playing, and it was genius. I mean, the stuff, when they say the cutting room floor, it wasn't like, he did 85... solos, and they were all brilliant, and I decided to go, fuck it, don't use them. But it was that, you know, he just played and played, and every take was amazing. I wish I could have included every single take. But I have a new approach, you know, as the tools have been provided us now, where I can capture live performances and then go back and manipulate them after the fact, which you could not really do very well with tape. I did a lot of it. I did more of it than most people, but it was still fairly limited. Now with digital technology, there's almost nothing you can't do. So for me, the idea is to get those great players to learn the songs before we get to the studio well enough that when we get to the studio, they're giving a performance. Mm-hmm. And I put them all together in the room. I make them all stand up like they're playing on stage. They can see each other. They get off on each other. I make sure that they can hear each other perfectly, that the atmosphere in the studio is one that, you know, of appreciation and it's performance oriented, and they know we're listening and they know we love it and they know we appreciate it. And I cut maybe three or four takes. So now there's not a lot of Steve Morse on these records that you don't get to hear.
Josh in Jersey. Go ahead, Josh. Thank you for waiting and being so patient. You're on with Bob Ezrin.
Hey, guys. Just a quick comment and then a question. I just want another shout out to the Lou Reed Berlin album. It's so amazing. And I know it wasn't well received back when it came out. And just good on you guys for sticking to your guns, because I'm only 24, but it's still a massively influential record. So just thanks again for that. It's great.
I'd love to hear that.
And my question is, it's been heavily rumored that Alice Cooper might be getting back together with his original band, maybe for an album, maybe for a tour. I personally don't think those guys get enough credit. That original band is so amazing. I'd love to see them live one day. They've done like a handful of stuff. So is there any truth to those rumors, or is it just...
Well, there's certainly... I mean, we have been working together, all of us. The original guys and Alice and I have been working together on some material. No, we're not doing a whole album with the original band, but we've done some songs. And they're getting a special Lifetime Achievement Award in Nashville in the middle of May, I believe. And then they're all going to play together there. And you never know what you don't know. But, I mean, we've really enjoyed being together. As we did, you know, we tried it out for Welcome To when we went into New York exactly 40 years after the day we met at Max's. We were in the studio in the Magic Shop in New York City and playing all together. And it was such a great feeling, great experience that we said we got to do it again. And so we just did.
So these guys will be on this new Alice record?
Yes.
All right. Well, there you go, Josh. You're getting a little taste of something.
There you go, Josh.
So look forward to that. Thank you for your call. Maybe time to squeeze in one or two quick ones before we have to wrap up. John in California. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Eddie. Hey, Bob. Just a quick question. I'm not the biggest Alice Cooper fan, but I did see him open
for
Motley.
Thank you for calling.
Go ahead. What do you got?
Go ahead, John.
But my uncle was a pretty big photographer in the 70s, and he took, I believe it was the Muscle Love album cover. I'm not sure if you did that album or not.
I didn't produce that, but Jack Douglas, who we talked about earlier in the show, along with Jack Richardson, so my mentor and my mentee, I put the two of them together to do that record. That was great. Anyway, that's a fantastic photograph.
Thank you, John, for the phone. Was there something else? Are you good?
The comedian... I'm going blank now, but it had the pot plants on the front, and then it was all stone on the back after there was no plants
Cheech
on the
Cheech and Chong?
No, what's his name? Big guy.
I don't know. I'm sorry, John, I got to run. We're almost out of time here, but thank you for calling. Real quick, Mike in Jersey. Jump in, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to mention that I think Dennis Dunaway is like, I would put him up against any bass player.
You know something? He just played some of the stuff on this album, like some of it with the other guys, the original guys, as we had discussed. But I also had him on a couple of songs that we co-wrote. He came in and played with the studio band in Nashville. He's phenomenal.
Huge thanks to Bob Ezrin, and thanks to the team at SiriusXM in Toronto for their help and assistance. It was great to interview Bob Ezrin and have him do the show. Like I said, so much more I could have gotten into, but we got a lot in that hour and a half, 2 hours that I spent with him. Hope you guys enjoyed that. Thank you for listening. Thank you for downloading and streaming each and every week. Be sure to follow on all my social media. I'm most active on Twitter at Eddie Trunk, Facebook, fan page Eddie Trunk, Instagram Eddie Trunk, eddietrunk.com is the website. See you at M3 this weekend if you're headed that way, or if you will be there in Columbia, Maryland. If not, I will see you out and about soon. Again, check eddietrunk.com on the homepage for all my appearances. Hope to see you out at some of them. Thanks to Katie Irizarry. As usual, she's the producer of the Eddie Trunk podcast, and I will see you next week, Thursday, actually, for another all-new episode on iTunes and podcastone.com.
I'm John Horn. I'm the host of Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. I'm here with our very first guest, Rainn Wilson.
Hi, John. It looks like I'm the first guest on the Geffen Unclothed. Unscripted. Unscripted. Yeah, let's go with that.
A marriage made in heaven, I guess.
Or Westwood.
Tune in for some of our exciting upcoming guests, David Copperfield, Neil LaBute, Neil Patrick Harris, Josh Gad, Rita Wilson, and many more. Be sure to download new episodes every Wednesday on the Podcast One app and on iTunes. And don't forget to rate, review, and share.
And I'm Rainn Wilson, the first guest.
You are the very first guest.
This was a huge mistake.
Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Huge mistake.